Today on the Florida Roundup, the invading sea. I'm Tom Hudson. The threat of sea level rise affects all of South Florida, from the ocean to the Everglades. The sea has risen 9 inches in the past century. It's predicted to rise another 2 feet in less than half that time. The Miami Herald, Sun Sentinel, and the Palm Beach Post, with reporting from WLRN, have teamed up to address the threat of higher seas to South Florida. Evidence of higher seas is all around us. Increased flooding, raising roads, flood pumps, encroaching saltwater. How much are you concerned about sea level rise? Has the issue affected any political or personal choices you've made in the past year? Flooding is a fact of life, and decades after carving out canals to drain South Florida, is our flood control system up to the challenge of higher seas? And what about flood insurance? All that and your phone calls coming up on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. On sunny days and rainy days, the evidence is there if you want to see it all around South Florida. Flooded streets and sidewalks and yards, brackish water in fresh water wells. Evidence of higher sea levels. The science shows sea levels have risen 9 inches in the past century in South Florida, and the science estimates another 2 feet in half that time. How much are you concerned about sea level rise in your neighborhood? The editorial boards of the three major news organizations in South Florida, the Miami Herald, Sun Sentinel, and Palm Beach Post, supported by reporting from us here at WLRN, have teamed up to confront the threat of higher seas. You can find all the coverage at the combined website, theinvadingsea.com. Now, it's a threat that retired Navy Vice Admiral Lee Gunn sees for the region's role in national security as well.
The bases in South Florida face the same challenges as these municipalities, as the cities and county in South Florida.
Has the issue affected any political or personal choices that you've made in the past? Let us know. The phones are open now, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet on social media. Look for us on Twitter, at WLRN. Greg and Coral Gable sent us this text. The climate crisis has led me to become politically active, to engage with conservative citizens, and to lobby Republican lawmakers to drive much-needed policies to reduce emissions. Ricardo in South Miami sent us this text. Very concerned, particularly with saltwater intrusion, he wrote. He says, we moved from Miami from the D.C. area 10 years ago and didn't sell our house in Maryland, in large part because, as much as we love it here, I was convinced there would come a time when South Florida would become unlivable. How about you and invading seas? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. The editorial page editors with our partners on this project are with us here on the Florida Roundup, the first of many conversations throughout all of South Florida, from the Keys up to the Palm Beaches here in South Florida. Nancy Ankrum is the editorial page editor at our partner, the Miami Herald. Rosemary O'Hara has that position at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And Rick Christie does that work at the Palm Beach Post. All three of you, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's tackle this, Rosemary, from this perspective. Lots of different sea level projections are out there. As we mentioned, the science shows 9 inches in the past century. The best science estimates about 2 feet or so by 2060. What is the threat posed by higher seas in South Florida?
Well, the threat that we face is South Florida understands that it's happening, that sea level rise is happening. The challenge we face is whether we think it's going to affect us in our lifetime. The issue is it's already affecting us. So the projections, is it going to be 40 feet in 40 years? Is it going to be 6 feet or 8 feet by the turn of the century? There are ranges of the projection. But the reality is the trend line is clear. It's happening. We're seeing things we've never seen before. We're seeing sunny day flooding. Yep. We're seeing the saltwater intrusion 6 miles inland now with a real our flood control system can't hold up. Last year we saw an octopus bubble up through a stormwater drain.
In a parking garage.
Yeah,
right.
In Miami Beach. We're seeing water bubble up from stormwater drains rather than drain down through stormwater drains because the sea level is rising. It's moving in through our porous limestone foundation and it is moving up, which means that there's no place for the rainwater to go. So we're seeing more flooding. So it is happening. And what's not happening is a plan for our region of how, what are we going to do about this?
For years, though, Nancy, we've had this Southeast Florida Climate Compact, this agreement amongst the four counties about climate change and resiliency and adaptation and mitigation, in other words, kind of response at the local level. Has that gone to a point of action?
It has gotten the attention of elected officials whose attention really was lacking here. My concern is that, you know, Rosemary just outlined everything that we're seeing that is evidence of sea level rise. However, what we're also still seeing are a lot of cranes in the air, a lot of high rises still on the horizon. And so there is a disconnect between whatever good the Climate Change Compact can do and elected officials who keep approving.
Yeah.
Such construction.
The land use debate when it comes to the response to sea level rise. And Rick Christie, the population continues to swell. 1,000 people a day move to Florida, about a third of those moving to South Florida. It arguably is a good problem to have when talking about the overall economy. But the fact of the matter is we need to have these policy discussions and policies about how to balance that population demand with our ability to respond to sea level rise.
Yeah, absolutely. And these are tough conversations to have because, as you said, Florida's economy is pretty much fueled by its growth,
mm-hmm.
and always has been. And so the politicians that and policymakers that Nancy was referring to earlier, their job, obviously, is to bring in as much tax revenue as possible so that they can provide services. And they're reluctant to stop a lot of the building that's going up along the coast, which is an incredible number. I mean, when she talks about the number of cranes and buildings going up, it is just incredible to see.
It's the coast, but it's also inland as well in some of these places that are miles and miles and miles away from a beach, from the Atlantic Ocean, are experiencing these sunny day floodings, are having trouble draining the rain when it falls.
Right, and that's where the flooding issue, the flood control issue that I believe Rosemary referred to earlier also comes in, where you have to have a flood control system that can handle this kind of things, because with the sea level rise, again, pushing further inland, there's nowhere for all the rainwater to go when you have just a tropical storm.
Yeah.
Palm Beach County dealt with that with Tropical Storm Isaac a few years back, where our western areas were really just inundated with rainwater that had nowhere to go.
Let's go to the phones here. Lots of calls already here as we're talking about the invading sea with our three newspaper partners here in South Florida, the Miami Herald, the Sun Sentinel, the Palm Beach Post, with reporting supported by WLRN, theinvadingsea.com. Confronting the threat of higher seas is what we're talking about here today on the Florida Roundup. Your phone calls at 800-743-9576. 800-743-WLRN. How concerned are you about rising seas? Has the issue affected any political or personal choices that you've had to take over the past several months or years, for that matter? We'll begin in Fort Lauderdale, where Fred is on line one. Fred, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts on this issue?
Yes, I'd like to point out that the Dutch took care of their problem with the high seas by putting in huge dikes and levees. We may have to resort to that. Why don't we take huge cement blocks, lay them down on the sand along Miami Beach as it is, in different gradations, shallower toward the edge of the beach, and thicker sand blocks further out, cover it with sand.
So, Fred, let me just tackle that. Just hold on here. Let's tackle that here, because the Dutch and the Netherlands is a place that a lot of folks who are engaged in this issue point to. One of the reasons that we've been told that kind of operation may not work so well here is geology.
Exactly.
The Ulai limestone that is beneath our feet, the Swiss cheese that we call our landscape, may keep the seas at bay on top, but it's not going to stop them, Nancy, underneath.
Right, exactly. And you know, the Netherlands aren't a tropical paradise either. And so any evidence of such an approach on the beaches suddenly turns, you know, what are our money makers into, you know, just places to stay away from.
Yeah, we're not going to turn things to tulip fields anytime soon, Fred.
The only thing that I can suggest then is more people are just going to have to buy boats and, you know, be satisfied with living on a boat.
living on a boat.
Isn't going to be enough land. I mean, it's the water is coming in at an incredible rate.
Gotcha, Fred. So, Fred's solution there, liveaboards. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it, Fred. Thanks for calling in here. Liveaboards, 800-743-9576. Chris in Miami has some thoughts. Chris, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio.
Hello. Yeah, I guess according to the other caller, we should live like Kevin Costner in Waterworld or something, learn hydroponics. Anyway, my concern is that, you know, a lot of people have this tendency to think that, you know, all the people that live in coastal areas can just move inland when they don't realize that half the world's population lives on coast just because of the way civilization formed. And then the other problem that I see is that, you know, we've had, like, political leaders that have been out there that have been misinforming or using pseudoscience or science studies taken out of context to convince people that climate change wasn't really happening or wasn't being caused by humans. But then you look at the, you know, the now that people are starting to see that it is impacting us and it is caused by humans, they're still listening to these political leaders that might still be misleading them and saying, yeah, it's happening, but we can't afford to change it and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he brings up, if I can, Tom, I think the caller brings up a very good point here in terms of the folks who have to buy into what's happening here. And one of the reasons we decided to go forward with this project in terms of raising awareness and making it a call to action, that the people who are responsible at the highest levels in terms of moving forward on this have to get on board with it, have to believe that this problem needs to be addressed now, and that it's not something that they can put off on future generations, our kids, our grandkids, or whoever are going to have to deal with not being able to live closer to the ocean or what have you. And I think the issue that he brought up is really goes to the core of what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, and Rosemary, I think the challenge and the disconnect in what the caller Chris is talking about and Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post, at the federal level, it is a climate change policy question. At the local level, at the state level even, it's perhaps more of a consequence of climate change policy debate. In other words, what is any singular municipality within the four counties of South Florida, for instance, going to do to affect the trajectory of climate change versus what are those four counties going to do to protect neighborhoods, to protect the revenue generating assets of the beaches, for instance?
Right. At the local level, there is a bipartisan agreement that this is real, this is happening, and we have to do something. And already they have baked, all four South Florida counties have baked into their building codes that 2-foot rise in sea level. Mm-hmm. So if you build something, you've got to just build to account for that. But at Tallahassee, even in Tallahassee, despite the economic powerhouse that is South Florida and the change that we're facing, we are not on the agenda there. And in Washington, you know, Washington is responsible for the intercoastal waterway, mm-hmm, and for the seawalls along there. And we need those seawalls raised. Mm-hmm. And Washington is responsible for our flood control system with the Army Corps of Engineers. It's 70 years old, and we need that addressed. And yet, because of the politics of climate change, they're sticking their heads in the sand. It's really why we are trying to frame this conversation in terms of sea level rise. Okay, you don't want to do anything about mitigating against what's happening with the climate and our contributions of carbon through fossil fuels. Okay, let's not talk about trying to slow down the rate, but let's start talking about how we're going to adapt. adapt to what is in front of our eyes. The sea is rising. There are things that if we do right now, if we start planning now, we will have a better, we will have a future here. It will be a different future, but we will have a future. The other thing, if I may just keep running on here, is that the thing that I hear too, the pushback, is that people are afraid we're scaring, we're going to hurt the economy, we're creating this, you know, threat, and mm-hmm. and that we're going to hurt the economy. Well, our economy is going to change, but there is business opportunity in the business of adaptation and in the business of energy and solar energy. And if we think not just about building high rises on the beach or inland, but start thinking about adaptation as a huge opportunity. Yeah. Let's be a leader in the world on how ground zero can adapt to a sea level rise. Yeah. There's opportunity here.
Elevation zero for sea level rise right here in South Florida. Nancy Ankrum?
Right, exactly. You know, also in outlining what we want to see from the federal level, we also need to keep an eye on what the EPA, the policies that the EPA has rolled back, mm-hmm. especially as it pertains to natural solutions to sea level rise. And we need to keep an eye on mangroves and the marshlands and the wetlands,
yeah.
which are natural barriers, which are able to absorb
yep.
you know, a lot of the
yep.
water.
Yep. Yep.
But they are in danger now
yeah.
because of the direction of the EPA.
Everglades restoration is
Absolutely.
A big part of that as well. I mean, you know, the Everglades restoration is can provide, the science tells us, a buffer. Of protection of sea level rise and the
right.
threat that is under our feet. So we're talking about the Invading Sea Project here with our editorial partners, the Miami Herald, the Sun Sentinel, and the Palm Beach Post, with reporting supported by WLRN. Your phone calls, 800-743-9576. Has this issue of higher seas affected your political or personal choices that you've had? Let's go to Wilton Manors in Broward County. Irene is on line 5. Go ahead, Irene.
So I want to say that I actually strongly disagree with what some of your editorial board was just stating about the local government, and that I think that they might be saying they're buying into this, but they have not changed their zoning codes to make requirements for developers to do things such as low-impact development or other types of development, whether it's structural or landscaping, that would not only reduce the heat island, but would increase groundwater recharge and, you know, decrease stormwater flooding, and that those cities that have done it a lot of times are just through recommended practices. But these cities can make it requirements. They don't have the political will to stand up to developers.
Mm-hmm. Irene, has this issue affected your vote?
It's more something professionally, but from a voting standpoint, I mean, absolutely, that, you know, statewide, I would never vote for Rick Scott. He won't even allow, you know, state employees to say climate change. So absolutely. But I mean, I think even locally, absolutely, you know, we need to vote for our local officials who will hold developers accountable.
Irene, that's a great perspective. Rick Christie, how about that? There may be buy-in on the page for the climate compact mm-hmm. from local governments, but what about an action?
Well, this is what we were speaking to earlier: is the balance that these officials, local officials anyway, have to try to maintain. Are they doing enough? Absolutely not. And I don't think we meant to say that at all. But in terms of buy-in, what we were speaking to was the fact that they are talking about it now a great deal. They're engaged in trying to figure out resiliency.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these governments now, particularly the county governments, have resiliency officers that are actually paying attention to this and trying to get ahead of this, even though they're a little bit behind. And so I think the caller is Irene is absolutely right that they aren't doing anywhere near enough, but. What I would really like to say is that's what we want to hear more of in terms of what
right.
we're
yeah,
doing. We
want
to
right.
hear people like Irene,
yeah.
you know, stepping up and pushing their local elected officials and policymakers to do something more than what they are doing. So, you know, hats off to her, and she needs to be telling more of her friends.
Nancy?
And, you know, if I can be reassuring to Irene and her concerns, Rosemary Rick and I plan to come together during this election year and really zero in as we interview candidates either individually or together about sea level rise and climate change. Where do you stand? What do you think needs to be done, if anything? Do you believe in climate change? It's that important.
That fundamental and that important here. Rosemary?
I would add to Irene's point, which is she's absolutely right on, that much more needs to be done, that the problem became so clear this year in Fort Lauderdale, where we see sewage running in the streets because our infrastructure is broken, where stormwater is leading to businesses not being able to open their doors because stormwater, we can't deal with it. And the issue of infrastructure and our need to deal with what's happening underground has not been on the horizon. Even in 2016, Broward was pushing a penny sales tax. Half of it would have gone for infrastructure, half for transportation. But the half that would have gone for infrastructure would not have gone for pipes underground or, you know, a new treatment plant. It was for parks and fire stations and a police station. So absolutely, our local people need to do more. The developers, though, say their pushback is that, well, you can't ask us as we build new buildings to have to pay for all these underground pipes. Well, somehow we got to figure out how we're going to pay for all those underground pipes.
Well, the city of Miami and voters recently approved borrowing of $400 million, about half of which will go to stormwater plans and raising of roads and those kinds of things. Lots of phone calls here at 800-743-9576. Lots of good engagement and conversation here. Dave in Fort Lauderdale, you've been holding on. Go ahead, Dave, your time.
Yes, I think it's a great idea to have this topic today. The concern I have is we seem to do a lot talking about resilience now, and maybe we talk a better game than we do, but I don't understand why we aren't doing more in terms of prevention. I mean, if anything, this region has a lot more at stake than some other regions that are higher above sea level, and yet I don't hear people talking about how we're going to reduce the CO2 emissions, whether it's transportation or better insulated homes or things like that.
Great point, Dave. I think we referred to that a little bit earlier about as it is certainly a federal policy issue. But how about that? I mean, Dave makes a point about transportation that certainly plays a role in carbon emissions, the insulation of homes, the amount of electricity that we use, how we get that electricity, how that's generated has changed in the past. There's certainly nuclear power plants here. There's solar investments that have happened, but also there's been a big shift away from petroleum, oil-based, and coal-based power plants into natural gas, which is still a fossil fuel, still generating a carbon footprint.
You know, I think that there are voices out there talking about those very things that David mentioned. Unfortunately, they haven't reached a critical mass. Unfortunately, they have not bubbled up so that we hear those solutions being considered by the people who can actually do something about it. And that very much, you know, those are our elected officials. We're here, we're hoping to give a boost to each county's resiliency office and officers. They are clearly plugged into these issues, but they need, one, they have to navigate the politics of
sure.
it all.
Sure, yeah.
And we're here to often be their megaphone.
But it is also, it's a comprehensive idea, and Dave, I think, gives voice to this about, you know, talking about resiliency, but not talking about the contribution to climate change, both of which are very important conversations, I think all of us would agree on. But then it gets down to, well, what can we do here in South Florida? And Rosemary, as you said, we're seeing the dry day flooding already. We're seeing the problems of neighborhoods draining after extreme storm events because of higher seas underfoot. These are the problems we're dealing with now that need to be addressed in addition to the broader existential question of the carbon footprint.
Right. And to the carbon footprint point, part, though. I mean, some of this is going in the opposite direction that it needs to go. In Washington, the president is talking about undoing the regulations for fuel efficiency for cars, which, you know, that and he's pushing the coal industry, which we know, you know, adds to the carbon footprint. In Tallahassee, they rolled back the incentives for getting solar rooftop because of, you know, the power industry doesn't want the competition that solar represents. So some of the things that he's talking about are expensive. People have a hard time paying, you know, $20,000-$30,000 to put a solar rooftop system in or to put their hurricane windows in. There are some new financing opportunities that the legislature did for windstorm, but they have not expanded those financing systems to flood. So, and part of that issue is, again, it's climate, the politics of climate change, and it's that in Tallahassee, at least, there's such a revolving door and the Capitol because of term limits, that the people who are there only want to deal with today's hot buttons. Mm-hmm. They don't want to deal with the big issues, and so they don't.
One more call here before we take a quick break. Kind of an interesting perspective here. Peter in Miami, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, thank you very much. This is Peter Ehrlich. I'm in the city of Miami. You're having a wonderful conversation and a great topic. Thank you very much. My question is about the City of Miami Commissioners. Yesterday, City of Miami Commissioners unanimously approved Formula One race racing event for possibly 10 years with vehicles get like a 1 mile per gallon. It seems completely contrary to sustainability, educating the public, sea level rise.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if you have a comment on that.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting marriage there, Peter, that you bring up. I hadn't put that together, and that's why I wanted to hear from that. It's certainly, you know, a celebration of speed fueled by fossil fuels, which is Formula One, but certainly I think exemplifies, Nancy, this friction between economic development and economic opportunity and the word and the deed of a resilient community.
Right, absolutely. However, we really need elected officials to look at to play the long game. Mm-hmm. And I understand the disconnect between Formula One and what we want to see happen. However, that is one event, that is one brief event. However, what we're seeing in terms of sea level rise is really being affected by our long-term development, our long-term neglect of the issue, and that's where I think elected officials really need to focus their energies.
Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think that the and I'm not as familiar with the what was going on in Miami with the Formula One, but that's it seems like it's really a matter sort of optics in the long run. And the optics that really we're kind of focused on is when you're standing out in the street and water is starting to come over your feet,
yeah, right.
You know, and you have no explanation for it other than the fact that, you know, oh, my goodness, the sea is encroaching.
The moon is in a certain
place
right now, and the winds are blowing in a certain
direction. Yeah, or you're in Delray Beach, you know, living close to the coast in Delray Beach or close to the intercoastal in Delray Beach, and in November for no other reason, as you said, other than the moon, you have king tides that are like, you know, moving water into your home. And I think for us, those kind of optics are the ones that we really want to focus on, yeah, because those are the things that you can see. Hmm. And so you can actually see, as I think Rosemary was saying from the outset when we started talking, sea level rise is something you can see now. And that is why we wanted to really focus on it, because it's not something that a politician can say to us that, oh, well, yeah, I know the climate is changing, but you really can't see it. Well, yeah, you can see this water. You can feel this water. And we need to do something about it. So what are you going to do about it?
The Invading Sea Project with our media partners, the Miami Herald, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and the Palm Beach Post, with reporting supported by WLRN. TheInvadingSea.com is where you can find all the coverage. Our conversation will continue with the editorial page editors from the papers and lots of your phone calls. Stay on the line, 800-743-9576. Is our flood control system up to the challenge of higher seas? That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening to public radio. Governor Broward, probably nobody remembers him a whole lot. You know the name Broward, however. He was only governor for 4 years in the early 20th century, but under his administration, Florida began carving canals out of the limestone and draining the Everglades. So the South Florida that we have today still relies on these canals to keep us dry. They're now managed by a series of agencies led by the South Florida Water Management District in our area. And the flood system is governed by gravity. As long as the fresh water on the peninsula is higher than the sea, the water engineers can keep our neighborhoods dry. The water can run out to the ocean. But higher sea levels are pushing back in some places, threatening parts of the drainage system. So what investment is needed to help keep us dry? Are you willing to pay higher taxes to deal with the infrastructure improvements that are necessary? Here we are talking about the Invading Sea with our editorial partners from the Miami Herald, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and the Palm Beach Post. You can find the coverage with the reports supported by WLRN at theinvadingsea.com. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number, 800-743-9576. David in North Miami sent us this text: we pay now or pay more later. Yes, he is willing to deal with higher taxes. Rosemary O'Hara with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post, Nancy Ankrum with the Miami Herald. All three of them are the editors of their various organizations' editorial pages. Let's talk quickly about kind of water management and the infrastructure involved here. Nancy, how threatened, how at risk is the canal and water management system that we rely on keeping us dry?
Well, it's very vital to keeping us dry. It needs serious upgrades, and the ability to move forward is actually stuck in Congress in terms of the studies that are needed, which will take a considerable amount of time too, to then move forward with upgrades.
Now, Rick, your newspaper reported this week about an inspector general report that came out that said the operation and maintenance budget of the South Florida Water Management District, according to this report, should be about $88.5 million, but it's only two-thirds of that.
Right.
Why the difference? Is it malinvestment, the lack of investment that's happened here?
Well, I mean, there seems to be some internal disagreement in the water management district as to how much they should be spending. But as you said, the IG's report, which took a year for them to do, came back and said you guys should be spending at least $88.5 million a year to maintain this system of around 2,100 miles of canals and 2,000 miles of levees. And the management district itself has only been spending somewhere around $53 million or something like that. One of the problems is that back in 2015, they had a chance to raise property taxes for the water management district to actually do more of this. The executive director at that time actually pushed for it, ended up getting canned by the governor because he did that.
Right.
And so I think they've been reluctant ever since to actually spend any more money. But the person who texted in is right that we need to spend this money now. And so you have a twofold problem at the Water Management District, and they're both at the state and the federal level. Again, there needs to be a brand new assessment for what needs to be done to upgrade this 70-year-old system that we have, which was remarkable when it was first created, of course. But 70 years later, Because you have not just the system that was created by the state of Florida and whatever federal part of that mm-hmm. there is, you now have a local problem in with Florida's growth. There are drainage districts yep. that are taxpayer funded that don't talk to one another. So in any given rainstorm, you may have one area of the county that floods. In the next rainstorm, this area floods because these guys aren't talking to one another. And if you go and hyper-local, where you have homeowners associations that build canals within their homeowners associations that drain out into these larger canals and don't tell anybody anything.
Yeah.
And so there really needs to be an assessment, first of all, on the federal level very soon, so that when we have these major rain events or hurricanes or whatever, tropical storms, that we don't have just flooding like we had in, say, for example, the Acreage with Tropical Storm Isaac,
yeah.
where people couldn't even see their yards or roads for days.
The fate of this, Rosemary, isn't it tied to taxes? Isn't it tied to the willingness of the public to invest? Because ultimately, the dollars that are going to come for the water management district are going to come from property taxes. That's the way that the revenue is sourced.
That's right. And as Rick said, when the governor believed that the water management district was too there was too much money going in there,
yep.
and so he didn't let their tax revenues rise as property values were rising. Mm-hmm. So they have less and less money to deal with the biggest issue that faces the future of our region. At the same time, in Congress, while there has been a study authorized by Congress to study our flood control system, which right now has 20 different parts of it that are at critical point. They can't open these floodgates on some days because, as you said, you know, the water on the other side is higher than the water that we're trying
right.
to run out.
No matter how much we want to debate science, water is going to run downhill.
Yeah.
Right, and water wins, you know. So, but in Washington, so they've authorized this study, but they haven't funded this study.
Right. Yeah.
So the outrage yeah. is that after Superstorm Sandy, after just one big storm in the Northeast, Congress not only authorized, but they funded a study of the flood control system in the Northeast.
Yeah.
Now, after all of the hurricanes, after all the tropical storms, after all the afternoon rainstorms mm-hmm. that we've had that leave water standing in our street, that threaten our future and our 70-year-old drainage system, Congress still has not funded a study of how are we going to fix this. And that's part of what this collaborative project is about, is we're outraged by this, and we're trying to raise the voice of our region to do something. What are we going to do about this? And together, we think that our voices will be louder, and we're going to, you know, hit you. I just want to say a little more about this. You've never seen anywhere a collaborative of
right.
three editorial boards.
Yep.
We are all owned by different companies. We are not used. We never have worked together. We, though, are friends. We respect one another, and we recognize that we all live in South Florida. We share the coastline. We share this flood control system, and we hold really special jobs. The job of an editorial board is really about informed opinion, about speaking truth to power, about speaking up for your community, the Times-Picayune did in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, saying, Mr. President, we need help.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we've done. That's what we're doing here, is we're speaking up for South Florida and saying, you know what? We need help. We don't know what all the answers are, but we know what the big questions are, and we plan to do it throughout the year. We're sharing editorials, so on the same day you see it in the Herald, you'll
yep.
see it in the Post, you'll see it in the Sun Sentinel. So we, in drumbeat fashion, are going to keep this in front of people's faces and hold people accountable for what are we going to do about this.
Because we share a common coastline, one of the roles that WLRN is playing in this project is to provide the public opportunity for real-time input on programs just like this here on the Florida Roundup. So with no further ado, let's get back to the phone calls then. Let's hear from the public. Jessica in Miami, you've been very patient. Go ahead, Jessica. You're on the radio.
Hi, yes. Thank you for bringing this topic up. My husband and I are actually recently looking to buy a place here in Miami, and it's so stressful to try and figure out which do you need to kind of take into account more, storm surge or just the flooding zone areas, and then trying to have to navigate that with insurance, because a lot of insurance companies are now starting to say, hey, you know what, we're not going to start covering only so much because you're living in an area that you're going to get flooded no matter what you do. So it's kind of just been a real pickle to deal with. So I'll leave that with you guys to talk about.
A real pickle there. Yeah. So the flood insurance issue, is that, I mean, it's one of your considerations, Jessica, to become a homeowner, to become a property taxpayer. That's going to get the ear of local officials, right? But
yeah.
Could that stop you from, you and your new husband, you and your new spouse?
It definitely makes us look about not actually buying a home, but maybe a condo that's higher up. Just so that way we don't have to worry as much about flooding as people who are buying homes right on the ground. Like, yeah. We looked at Coral Gables in different areas in Miami, and everywhere there is a flooding issue no matter where you really look, unless you travel way far out, and then you have to deal with traveling and commute.
Yeah.
And so just no matter what you do, it's going to be an issue.
You live in Florida, after all, where water is a fact of life, no doubt. Well, good luck on the real estate front there, Jessica, in Miami. And the trouble, Nancy, what Jessica's talking about here really shows, again, that friction of the economy and resiliency here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I have a friend who's a biologist, and her tagline on her email says, Mother Nature, remember, Mother Nature bats last, and she bats 1,000.
Indeed.
And that is what we're seeing here, yeah. And that is really what we need. The right people, the stakeholders, the people we have put in office to deal with this, to take, yep, stewardship of this community, of the environment, of the residents, that is what they need to realize.
Back to your phone calls now at 800-743-9576, talking about our Invading Sea project here on WLRN. Chris is in Miami. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the radio.
Oh, well, thank you. First of all, I enjoy it and appreciate the show, Tom, and I appreciate the topic.
Thank you.
I have a very contrarian point of view. I've lived here for 55 years. I think that the public is not adequately informed as to what exactly the rates of sea level rise are. 5 millimeters a year does not mean that the Earth is going to end tomorrow. 5 millimeters a year is about 1 inch in 5 years. So this is not a crisis today. The things I think that everybody can agree on, fix the things that need to be fixed today, fix the things that need to be fixed tomorrow. I certainly do not support higher taxes, and I'm opposed to, I'm opposed to this idea that, let's just put it this way. The seas have been rising for 2,000 years. We can see that the English lived 300 feet closer to the sea 2,000 years ago. It's something that can be, that humankind is successfully dealt with for 2,000 years, I think that we have the tools to continue to do so without alarm.
Chris, I think that the argument would be England 2,000 years ago may have been developed in a much different way than Miami Beach or Delray Beach or Doral or Weston is today.
Yes, but for example, the Netherlands, they reclaimed 26 feet deep, 26 feet deep of sea. You know, we have the
right,
technology.
But the geology, as we pointed out before, the geology is different in every place, and certainly the ocean temperature and all of those types of things are different as well. But so Chris, let me ask you this, Chris. I mean, I don't think your opinion is contrary, despite what you may say. But what do you think? What is the priority for you, for somebody who says this is a long-range game? I think someone here, in fact, discussed that as well. What are the problems that should be fixed in your estimation today, and what are the problems that could be left for tomorrow?
So when you have flooding on Alton Road, for example, that's causing destruction or disruption of your economic life and your citizens' happiness and life, sort of like that, fix that. When you're talking about, having a water system that doesn't drain, and so, you know, you have 2 weeks of time to delay when you have to drain after a storm, fix that by putting your pumps in so you're no longer doing gravity delay. We agree. That's why I say build a consensus on the things that everybody agrees on that need to be fixed. Once you do that, I think the problems will take care of themselves. The Yale Report, the biggest publication on a studying on the remediation of sea level rise, said that the improvement in the economy goes faster than the increase in cost of remediation.
So the growth in the economy is going to go faster than how much it will cost to fix problems after they've already happened, or to address problems before it becomes a disaster.
So what it's saying is
because the federal government has shown time and time again, a dollar invested in preparation is worth four in cleanup.
I understand the point, but the Yale report, which is, I think, is the gold standard on climate change and remediation, suggests that, you know, going back to areas that we agree on, for example, I'm all in favor of mangroves, fixing the mangroves, putting out, you know, storm surge protection, you know, and those kinds of things I think you could get a broad agreement on.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about spending, you know, trying to put $1 trillion, $1.7 trillion, which was the local, which was the most recent estimate for fixing the top, I think it was 13 cities, that $1.7 trillion is just so far out of the park about what people are going to be willing to spend. I don't think that you're going to get a consensus on that figure.
Chris, we got it. We're going to leave it there. Appreciate the input, though. Yeah, great conversation, Chris. Thanks so much. You can join as well, 800-743-9576. We will continue with the three editorial page editors from the South Florida newspapers, the Miami Herald, the Sun Sentinel, and the Palm Beach Post. Your phone calls as well. The Invading Sea and theinvadingsea.com, our project here with WLRN. 800-743-9576 as the roundup continues after this. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for joining us here as we are beginning on the Florida Roundup a series of conversations with the three editorial page editors at the South Florida newspapers, Rick Christie at the Palm Beach Post, Nancy Ankrum with the Miami Herald, Rosemary O'Hara with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with reporting supported by WLRN on the Invading Sea Project. Theinvadingsea.com is the website where all of the coverage can be had, and your conversation is a big piece of this over the next several months. 800-743-9576 is the telephone number. Let's go up north to Jupiter, where Lou has been holding patiently on. Go ahead, Lou. You're on the radio.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I understand the concern people have with this whole situation, but what I don't understand is our modern and recent concern where we think we've got it all figured out. If you go to Mount Dora, Florida, it's right near the highest point in the state, mm-hmm. at about 365 feet above sea level, and you dig in the soil, you hit shell rock. Mm-hmm. There are shells there. You find the evidence that sea life was once on top of the state, and we were that deep underwater. And the people on the show already stated how Florida was, you know, dredged and canaled and drained because the water was so high, you know, back at the turn of the century. And now all of a sudden, it's all man's fault. And I don't think that man doesn't have something to do with it. But as a lot of people in the science world that I've spoken to are stating, that we do not have a clue as to what degree or percentage of the sea level rise is due directly to man and the supposed climate change. The fossil evidence.
So, Lou, let me ask you though, as a resident of Jupiter, as a longtime resident of Florida, how much does that matter to you? How much does that matter to your neighborhood about the cause of it, as opposed to the fact that the seas are rising?
Well, as one of your recent callers just mentioned, you know, this has been going on throughout humanity's history for years. And we've been finding ways of dealing with it. What is a concern to me is how modern people who have built modern structures in areas that are in floodplains, like Miami, continue to allow such movement and generations of people being allowed to build in these areas that are in harm's way. We may need to be looking at our building codes, and we may be needing to do something about density, but nobody wants to hear that.
Yeah. And, Lou, we all may be moving up north into your neighborhood in the next half century or so. Make room for us in Jupiter, Lou, will you?
It's something that people with very expensive real estate are going to be upset about when all of a sudden they can't sell their place because it's underwater.
That's right. But literally, not like figuratively. Yeah, go ahead, Lou. Time's tight.
I would like to ask somebody there who's a scientist, you know, what percentage exactly of climate change is caused by man as compared to the cyclical effects of the ocean
All
and
right.
Earth
we will,
millions of years?
We'll let that rhetorical question hang out there, Lou, but we appreciate that. I want to get one more quick call in here because we haven't heard from Monroe County, the most exposed of our listening area here at WLRN. Tanya is on the line. Go ahead, Tanya. Time's tight, but I wanted to make room for you.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I actually have only been a Monroe County resident for about 8 months. I came from rural western Palm Beach County, Loxahatchee, and I really just feel like so much of the responsibility falls on the developers. We were in an area, a rural area, for 25 years that, as I said, during Isaac, we had serious flooding all the way up to our doors.
Yeah.
Tons of damage.
You don't think it's going to be better for you in Monroe County, do you?
No, but I'm going to be a lot happier.
So noted. I got to leave it on that note because we're up against the clock. Rick Christie, real quick, some final moments here in our first engagement with the invading sea.
Well, what I found interesting that even the people who call up saying that they're contrarian end up basically they're agreeing with everything we said.
That's true. Nancy, how about you?
Right. We are going to be on this, and we really are here to be advocates for the people out there whose voices aren't being heard but who are concerned.
And Rosemary?
The sea is rising. We have to have a plan now. We are hoping people will help their voices be heard. We encourage people to keep up with our effort at theinvadingsea.com.
Yep. And we'll continue to hear those voices here on WLRN and report throughout the next several months on the sea level rise project. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Leprey. Teresa Frontato, our digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. Technical supervisor today, Pilar Uribe. Thanks, Pilar. Thanks again for calling and listening.